This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at the Zen Center of New York City. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery and ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, case 79. Chengsha advancing a step, the pointer. The Bodhisattva appearing as a maiden on the banks of golden sand was a special spirit. Stuffing pastries into a crystal jar, who would dare to roll it? Without going into the frightening waves, it's hard to find a suitable fish. How about one expression of walking relaxed with big strides? The case. Changsha had a student ask Master Hui, "How was it before you saw Nanquan?" Hui remained silent. The student said, "How about after seeing him?" Hui said, "There couldn't be anything else." The student returned and related this to Changsha, and Changsha said, "The person sitting atop the 100-foot pole, though they've gained entry, this is not yet the real. Atop the 100-foot pole, you should step forward. The universe in all directions is the whole body." The student said, "Atop the 100-foot pole, how can you step forward?" Changsha said, "The mountains of Lang, the rivers of Li." Student said, "I don't understand." Changsha said, "The whole land is under the imperial sway." The poem. The jade person's dream is shattered. One call from the rooster. Looking around on life, all colors are equal. Wind and thunder with news of events roust out the hibernating insects. Peach trees, wordless, naturally make a path. When the time and season comes, laboring at the plow, who fears the spring rose knee-deep mud? Good morning. I always like this going, and I wanted to do this in two parts. First part today and second part tomorrow. And what I wanted to do today is talk about getting to the top of this 100-foot pole, this image of reaching the top of a pole or ascending to the top of the mountain is an image that comes up again and again, and not just in Buddhism, but in other spiritual traditions, a sense of a pilgrimage or of the journey itself as an ascent. But it has a particular meaning in Buddhism that this koan takes up. So in a way, I won't deal too much with the koan directly today because it's really talking about how do you step forward, presuming that we're at the top of that 100-foot pole. And this koan is, this collection, the Book of Serenity, was actually collected by Hong Zhu, who was a Chinese master who taught what was called in the school of silent illumination. When Dogen went and studied in China and then came back, he taught shikantaza, which means just sitting, just aware. And so Hong Zhu was of the Soto tradition, what we call the Soto tradition, the Japanese pronunciation. And he compiled this collection of 100 koans and then wrote the verses. And he was a renowned poet. And so any of you who've read the Cultivating the Empty Field, that's a collection of his teachings. And so he has really an exquisite poetic voice and use of language, and merge with his deep understanding is really quite something. And so this collection has this beautiful poetry. So it's nice. and, you know, the koans do, you know, he's speaking in the time, in his time. And so he's using language, he's drawing upon images and making references that made sense, you know, that was understood in his time. And so part of it is, you know, understanding those references. And sometimes we need help. You know, we there are footnotes and, you know, we need, because it's hard to make sense of them without that. But other times, you know, like in the pointer when he says, stuffing pastries into a crystal jar, who would dare to roll it? So what is he describing there? Right? So we really have to enter into that. So if you've got pastries and you put them in a jar and you start rolling it, what's going to happen? Right? And so that he's preparing us. He's pointing towards something that the koan takes up and that we'll get to mostly tomorrow. So ours is a path of liberation. The Buddha made that clear again and again throughout his whole teaching life. And what we know, the first noble truth, is that as practitioners, our task is to understand that teaching, the first noble truth, that life is dukkha. Right? And so, which means we have to recognize that within ourselves, and we also then have to examine what did the Buddha mean when he said dukkha, which we translate as suffering, disappointment, dissatisfaction. I received a letter recently from an inmate that was a first-time letter, and he said, you know, if you ask me who I am, I'm a 6'4" white guy. I weigh 200 and some odd pounds, but if you really ask me who I am, I haven't a clue. He said, I am utterly lost. He said, but I've encountered Buddhism, and I can't even call myself a Buddhist because I've only encountered it 2 weeks ago. He said, but I so deeply hope that it's true. Because what I'm encountering in these teachings is the first thing in my life that has felt true and that it makes sense to me. But I don't even understand it. And then he was asking, you know, he said, I need help. Help me. Kind of an extraordinary letter, very simple. Very familiar. And so recognizing that life is dukkha and all that that means, in a sense, you know, we spend years practicing, understanding more and more what that means because there's so many levels of that. There's so much depth to that in terms of how the Buddha understood that. And that there is a path. The path is to be practiced. And that wherever we begin, every step, we are practicing within Buddha nature. Every step within samsara, when we are entangled in our entanglements, we are perfect and complete, lacking nothing. And that is the great tension, isn't it? That's the great apparent conundrum. Apparent because there is no conundrum. It's just true. The conundrum is when we try and reconcile that in our mind. Is it this or is it that? And we have to seek. We have to seek. Right? We have to seek the Dharma. We have to seek a way through or beyond or out, however we might think of it in the beginning. Because if we don't, we're going to keep creating the very thing that we're trying to free ourselves from. The sense of self, sense of distance, the entanglements themselves. And so we have to seek, but knowing that even in that, we are also to some degree creating those very things, a sense of distance, a sense of looking outside, a sense that this is not perfectly complete. But that's okay, really, because if we're sincere and we practice, that all becomes more clear over time. And so, in a sense, practicing is a continual development of a refinement of becoming closer and closer to the Dharma, closer and closer to the actual teachings, aligning, which is really just coming home. You know, it's not like putting on, you know, a pair of pants and a shirt that don't fit and you keep trying to make them fit and eventually they fit. It's like taking all that off. So what is the path? What is this image of ascending the mountain? How do we have aspiration? You know, this is a path. And so how do we have aspiration to free ourselves and to, which means to travel, right? To travel this path, right? We start where we are. We're trying to do something about that. And how do we have that sense of development or evolution or unfolding or progress, but without grasping, without creating expectation, without objectifying that which has no inherent substance? How do we actually make progress on the path without measuring? So the Buddha said we have to develop our moral being. We have to stop, we have to work towards, you know, living in a way that is more harmonious with ourselves and the world. We have to stop creating trouble. And we need to develop our mindfulness. We have to calm those waves, develop samadhi, and bring forth prajna, insight, realization. And so what I wanted to talk about today is tranquility, shamatha in the Theravada tradition, samadhi, calming the mind, all of these different ways we have of speaking of this. because this constitutes such an essential, you can't even talk about it as a part of Buddhism. It is Buddhism. And within it, you could say everything else is included, because how we're living our lives has a direct impact on our meditation, on our mind. I talked about this at the Mondo a few days ago. And a direct impact on insight and awakening. And so developing our mindfulness and to appreciate, you know, everyone should really study what mindfulness is in Buddhism. You know, don't just, we shouldn't just, you know, hear these words and kind of come to our own conclusions. I did that. I mean, when I first started hearing about mindfulness, I thought, that doesn't sound very powerful, right? I didn't understand what it was. And I just assumed that I did. And I thought, you know, I'm more interested in something deeper, right? I was being foolish, right? I was being, assuming that I understood, and I didn't. Thank goodness we live long enough get over ourselves. And so within mindfulness, the reason it's important to study is one, because culturally, now societally, it has a presence, and its presence, the way it's often presented and depicted, is kind of one or two dimensional. There's an incredible teaching and understanding of mindfulness within Buddhism. And so that when you bring your attention, you know, attention is understood as what you bring your focus to. So when you focus your mind in your breath, you're working with your attention. Okay, so that's an aspect of mindfulness. And within that, as you are sitting and are aware of your body, of your breath, of sound, of sensation, that's called alertness. So that you know that you're in your body and mind, that you're practicing, that you're sitting on the ground, that you're in this space. Your senses are open, right? You're alert. That's what alertness means. So you bring your attention, focus your mind. Alertness is being aware of here. And then things arise. Thoughts and emotions and memories and the whole 10,000 things. And so the Buddha said ardency, having ardency, is recognizing what arises and recognizing whether this is something that is not helpful to you. It's not skillful for you to strengthen this. And so you practice not strengthening it, practice letting that go, diminishing. And sometimes that happens in a moment, and sometimes you have to work at that, right? because it's old or it's deep or it's strong or you don't want to give it up. And so sometimes it happens a second, sometimes it takes a long time to continually work at that every time it arises. And then on the other side, what are the things that are actually helpful that you see arising in your zazen that you recognize as positive aspects of your meditation, positive aspects of your own nature that are skillful, that are working on your better behalf? And so you strengthen those, not by attaching to them, but by doing what will help those to become stronger and more stable and more consistent. That's ardency. In developing tranquility, in calming the mind, Buddhism teaches that there are things that we need to be attentive to. So one of those is, what is our environment? Is our environment actually helping us? And you can think of that as our immediate environment. And so today we create an environment, and the temple is here to do that, to create an environment that is suitable, that's conducive, that's encouraging. So we minimize distractions and noise and clutter and so on. But we can think of that in a larger sense too, our sort of life environment, the environment that is our home, our relationships, our work. And not to try and have absolute control, but just as recognizing that's part of this. That when I sit on my cushion, I'm not isolated from that. From where I am in my immediate, in that immediate moment, and where I am in the larger sense. Like, where am I coming from to get to that cushion? Where am I going to when I get off that cushion? That environment. To be free from excessive desire. Excessive desire. In other words, that it's conducive to calming the mind, to developing serenity, tranquility in the mind, to not be filled with excessive desire. So what desire would be appropriate? The desire to actually practice, the desire to settle your mind, the desire to not plan your day, right? To not write a book about the Dharma, right? Or about yourself, right? The desire to actually do zazen would be a good desire, right? But don't hold that in excess. Don't fixate on it, don't solidify it, don't attach to it. To be content, which basically means when you're sitting, to be basically at ease, to be accepting of where you are, of what you are, to not be fighting against that. It doesn't mean that everything's perfect. It doesn't mean you have everything you want. But just a basic contentment. Now, here you are. You're okay. This is okay. Not fighting. To be free from excessive activities. Right? And that contentment could also, you know, you could look at all of these in terms of, you know, what's happening right now when you're sitting, but also in a larger sense in our life, that we're moving towards contentment, which isn't static and it's not fixed, but it is a sense of being at ease within our lives with the world as it is, and also as we can help make it. To be free from excessive activities, right? All of our lives are active. We are active in our lives. That's what it means to be alive. But excessive activities. And we live in a time of excessive activity, right? This is part of our madness, is that has become not just normal, but expected. I hear this over and over and over, right? I mean, the signs of it are everywhere. I mean, it's something we have to work with at the monastery. And that can be sometimes, you know, our excessive activity can come out of anxiety. It can come out of just the place we're in and the expectations that we have. You saw that article in the Times a few weeks ago about the state of women in Japan. It was a really interesting article. And this woman who was talking about how, you know, that in Japan, most of the work that is done in the household is, the vast majority is still done by women, who are now being encouraged to and are more and more working out. You know, so they're still doing everything at home and having jobs, which she said she has to apologize to leave her work, her office, at 10 o'clock at night. She has to apologize for leaving early, and she's pregnant. And so these various worlds that we have created, right, not just here in the New York or in the U.S., that are excessively active, right, and how the effect that that has. I mean, this is what all of these are talking about, the effect that these have on our desire to develop our meditation, which is not just about developing our meditation, right? It's about how we live our lives. To have a pure morality, right? And so, as I say, to not strive for perfection, let's say a healthy morality, a morality in progress, you know? We're actively working on, you know, trying to live well, make good decisions, you know, treat people well, treat ourselves well, take care of the earth, you know, be a good citizen. And no conceptual proliferations. All right. So again, obviously this is going to be conducive, but so it means practicing proliferating concepts. And so these are the conditions or causes for tranquility. Now, there's a Tibetan Buddhist teaching. You know, there are so many teachings on the development of mindfulness and letting that deepen into concentration, because so much of our practice is based in this, right? That if we don't interrupt the karmic patterns and habits and cycles that have helped raise bodhicitta, you know, awakened us to understand that life is dukkha, then those cycles will continue because that's their nature, and not just because they're acting on their own, but because we will continue to perpetuate them. And so to interrupt and shift or dissolve those cycles is going to take some considerable effort and a sustained effort. And so one of the teachings is nine stages, Tibetan Buddhist teaching, of resting the mind. It begins with placing the mind. So again, attention is where you put your mind. In the breath, it's in the breath. On a koan, it's in the koan, it's in the question. Shikantaza, it is in awareness itself. Visualization practice is going to be in that visualization. Placing the mind, so it's counting the breath. It's the sound as you inhale. And the breath itself, placing that in the breath. You're placing your mind in the breath, in the sensation. And in that, you are aware of that breath in your body, right? That's alertness. Your mind is alert, right? And as things arise, you're aware of the quality, sort of the moral, the skillfulness of what arises. That's ardency. And then you're trying to hold your mind there. So you're holding the mind. And that doesn't mean like in a vice. And yet sometimes, because the mind is all of these, the first six of these nine stages are all dealing with the wildness of the mind, right? So does it give you any comfort when you read these teachings that are ancient, they go back hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's like, oh, their minds were restless too? Their minds were wild too? Like there are six stages that are just dealing with the wildness of the mind? Like it's not just me? I hope that gives you comfort. It always gave me comfort. It's like, oh, I'm not just uniquely like crazy or ill-suited for sitting. This is just a modern thing, right? And so we're trying to hold the mind there, right? Which is in that sensation, in that place, whatever that is, right? And then the second stage is place again. So placing and then place again, because the mind wanders. And so you place the mind again. You bring your attention, because what happens when the mind wanders is our attention shifts from the breath to whatever arose, right? Because that's very interesting, right? And the habit is of doing that, just doing that. Doesn't matter whether it's interesting or not. It can be completely banal. But the habit is to do that. It's just to shift the attention to whatever is moving. Whatever is moving, it grabs the attention. And so to place again is to practice shifting that attention, which is you could think of as your energy, your mental energy, your focus, back to the breath, right? Which means to notice when the mind wanders. So that's the function of alertness. You realize you're not in that awareness of your mind and body being in the breath. You become alert to your distraction in the moment when you realize you're somewhere else, right? Your alertness, in a sense, helps you to realize, oh, I don't know where I just was. There wasn't any alertness. I don't know where I was, but now I do. I realize, oh, my mind wandered, right? And so that's the function of that. And then your attention, you shift your attention. There's a deliberate action. You are choosing in that mind to bring your mind back and place it again. And of course, the challenge is that our attachments are still very strong. Not just to the things we're attached to, but to attachment itself. We don't just wander because we're interested in what's going over here. We're interested in just wandering, right? The object is often irrelevant, although it assumes relevance, right? Once we start to settle into it, because it has to have relevance in order for us to feel like we're in control and we're like, you know, living a worthwhile life. So we have to give it meaning. But it's important to understand both of those functions, that the object itself is compelling, but just the habit of wandering, that's a lot of what we're working with, just the energy of that, just wandering. Right? Well, that's why samsara means to wander, just to wander. The image that's often used is of a pig who's in a large, vast, open field. But there's a garden over here. And the pig wants to get in there and eat what's in the garden, right? So it leaves that vast open field to get into that garden, which means they have to dig under this fence, you know, get scratched by the wire, you know, but it's worth it, right? Because that's where all the good stuff is. And so the role of the gardener is to keep sort of pushing them back out into the field, get back out there, right? But the gardener is the gardener. You want to get to that pig before they get to the food, because once they get that food in their mouth, they don't want to leave, right? Because now they're on it, right? So it's much harder to shoo them away once they've bit into that vegetable, that flower. So you want to be quick, right? Don't want to dawdle. And it's a great analogy. It's a great sort of metaphor for what actually happens, right? As soon as we bite into it, we get the taste of that, then we want more. And so we need to try. That's what we're trying to do. Tracing back means to, in one sense, means to trace back to earlier, before that energy is built up, right? Before all of that other stuff is brought in, the meaning, the purpose, the associations, the pleasure, whatever we're getting from it. Because then it's much easier just to come back. Which is why when we judge, as soon as the judging mind hooks in, it is going to be harder to let go, because the judgment is always based in what we believe to be true, and it's always deeply personal. And so it's very hard to pull ourselves away from that. And so that's why if we can get to, you know, that a shift in our attention before the judgment arises, it's much easier to bring it back. In the teachings, there's so many teachings about, you know, the conditions conducive for developing this, but also those obstacles. And so two of the main obstacles to creating, calming the mind, to developing tranquility or serenity in the mind, samadhi, is dullness and agitation. And so these are just inclinations and tendencies that exist within every human being, everywhere, in any situation, right? Is to incline towards dullness or to incline towards agitation. That's what we do. It's sort of a different way of thinking of the Buddha's talking about the two extremes of one is denial and one is grasping, actively grasping and trying to preserve. One is no and one is yes. It's just a different, slightly different aspect of that. So dullness, one teacher described as a heaviness of mind and body whereby both become unserviceable. It's kind of nice. So when we're dull, like there is a mind and body, but we can't really get to it, right? We can't really put it to good use. It's being used, but not very well. And there's a kind of heaviness, right? A kind of weight that we experience, right? Sort of holds us down. And so that can appear in the form of boredom, of kind of disinterest, a kind of numbness, disassociation, a kind of quiet dullness. The mind can be quiet, but dull. So it feels kind of good, right? Because there's not much agitation, but it's dead, right? It's got no life, which means it's not helping us to develop because it's static. And remember that when we're practicing, we're training our mind. So when we, in a very powerful way, more powerfully than when we're just not practicing. In other words, whatever we're doing in a more concentrated way, which means we're developing that more strongly. And so when we spend a lot of time in distraction, or we indulge our distractions, we're teaching our mind to do that. We're making that stronger, which means we're making it harder to let that go. When we sit and are kind of complacent within our complacency, you know, and I'm not saying this to be afraid that, you know, if you waver an inch, you know, it's over, it's doomed. But when we more actively dwell in these various states, then we're more actively training our mind to seek them out, and it becomes harder to let them go. And so that quiet dullness is it happens to every student, because as you practice, you're going to have experiences where your mind becomes more tranquil, right? And it does feel good, right? And that's telling you something. That's not an accident. That's a direct validation of what happens when your mind assumes its more natural state, is you experience it through your senses as pleasurable, pleasing. But when it becomes dull, then there's a kind of attachment to that. And usually what happens is we're no longer practicing the breath. Our attention has shifted to just that sense of quiet, and we've turned that into something, right? So that's why what you want to do is stay with your practice. And then that will naturally deepen. And so all these different forms of dullness, and everybody experiences this, everybody. And so it's just part of developing our skill at how do you recognize it and then rouse yourself, you know, brighten your mind. And then, of course, on the other side is agitation, the other side of that, where things enter a heightened state of excitedness, and that can be actual excitement about something. It can be, you know, sexual excitement. It can be anger. It can be fear. And a teacher said, agitation is being obsessed, thinking ceaselessly about an object. And so if we think about it in those states of mind, in those moments, there's something that we're thinking about, right? If it's a sexual fantasy, we're thinking about someone. If it's fear, it might be we're thinking about someone or something. If it's anger, we're thinking about someone or something. So there's an object that we have become obsessed with and that we're constantly thinking about. And so that creates agitation. And so those are the two sort of states that we have to be continually just aware of, right? And develop our capacity to sharpen, enliven, bring ourselves back from that state of dullness or numbness, right? And everybody that comes into practice, myself included, that I've ever met, begins in some degree of numbness, right? I mean, it's a pretty handy tool to protect ourselves from insanity, right? Pain and suffering from something that we don't know how to fix or something that is just too uncomfortable to experience. We just sort of shut it down, just turn those motors off. Right? It's very helpful when we don't know what else to do. Right? It seems to help. And it's not that it's necessarily conscious, although it could be. And everybody has that capacity. It's universal. And that's part of why it's so hard to let go of, because it seems to work so well. And it does, in a way, protect us, but not really. Right? Because in the same time that we're shutting ourselves down to what's harmful or hurtful or negative, we're shutting ourselves down to everything. You know, we can't compartmentalize that way. And we're training ourselves to do that. So we really do need to, you know, muster ourselves out of that dullness, and at the same time, be aware of the tendency towards all the different states of agitation and the allure of that. You know, we can take that for aliveness. We can take all these different states of agitation as being engaged or being interested or being concerned or just being alive. And so then there's also placing closely. So there's placing again. I missed that one. The mind is still wandering, so we bring it back. And here it's because the attachments are still strong. They're still active, which means the habits are still strong and the belief in them is still present. And so we have to continually keep placing again. And then the next stage is to place closely. Right? So here, you know, it's like in the beginning, the breath is somewhere in here. And we're like, you know, way out here circling around, right, looking for that breath. We know that we're breathing because otherwise we'd pass out, right? But there are moments where it's hard to find it. And so that circle starts to get closer and closer. We see it, we feel it, it's becoming more present, we're able to stay with it. The first traces of actual tranquility, calming the mind, of samadhi begin to come forth, right? And the sense that naturally arises, that we experience things as more spacious, as larger, right? Which logically doesn't make sense. I mean, it's not a measurable thing, but it's a direct experience. There's less confinement, even within experiences that before were very confining, like tension or tightness or a strong emotion. You're experiencing them, but not in the same way. There's something that is less restrictive, less overpowering about those emotions. The body is relaxing at the same time that there is an increasing state of wakefulness. You know, this is why, you know, when teachers and you know, developed practitioners are able to, you know, practice vigorously, intensively, you know, like in Sesshin, why do we wake up so early? Out of enthusiasm. That's why. Can't wait to get there. Sayan has told this story about when she was rooming with Kaijin, who was many years her senior. You know, Kaijin at that point was probably in her 70s. And she would get up early to sit. And she was much older than Sayan. And she would get her up and say, "You're going to have plenty of time to lay down once you're dead. Get up." That enthusiasm, right? Now, obviously, we don't always feel that. But that's really why, you know, why don't we have a 2 or 3 hour lunch? You know, kick back, big Italian meal, lots of conversation, enthusiasm for practice, right? For practice the way we practice when we are coming together and practice intensively. And so that's part of what's being roused within us, right? That practice goes from being a kind of medicine, you know, something that we need to do, we want to do, but not always, you know, so there's that struggle of getting to the cushion, working, having to work with ourselves. and that resistance where it becomes more and easier, more joyful, more naturally present. And that as the thoughts arise, emotions, memories, they're still arising, but they're lighter. They're not so tenacious, right? There's more space. And they become more and more like subtle disturbances, subtle movements in a larger field. You know, when you've got a little puddle, just a little, you know, just dropping a tiny pebble in just, you know, creates a tidal wave. In a vast ocean, you drop a pebble in, you hardly notice. And all along the way, one of the things that's so important here is intention, your intention, a desire. And not just vaguely somewhere in the background, but an expressed intention that you are expressing to yourself, within yourself, on a daily basis, what you want to be giving to your life today. I really think this is, this is Buddhism. This is Buddhist teaching. Each of us has the most powerful force in this world, in the human world. And that force is your ability to form an intention. That sets karma into motion. That creates karma, which just means change. With that intention, you are creating change. And when you do that well, when the intentions are well expressed, well placed, they're actually working in service of your own liberation. And you do that again and again and again. And it begins to infuse in your body so that you are actually living out of that intention. Then you are a force to be reckoned with. And so intention, Tashi Namgyal, a Tibetan teacher, said, intention propels us forward to make effort so that we practice our sitting in such a way to be able to release the obstacles of dullness and agitation. And so when we're in the grips of these, you know, struggles, these forces, these energies, you know, that we're not just sitting waiting for something to change. We're not waiting to be rescued. We're also not waiting, just trying to destroy it, right? We're trying to practice skillfully. And so we bring forth, right, either expressed or just explicit within the way we meet it, our intention to be wakeful, not dull, to be at peace, not agitated. And this is moving towards pacifying. Thich Nhat Hanh has said so often, to be peace itself. Because the mind still has a tendency to wander. I mean, this is telling us, right? This is telling us that it's not just you and that you're doing something wrong. That is why it takes so long, you know, in a period of Zazen or in a day of Zazen Kai, and also over time for you to bring your mind, you know, to these deeper states. And so this is where, you know, being more inside of the practice, more unified, we begin to see more of the Dharma in what's in front of us. We see the impermanence of these thoughts. We see it. It was there all along, but we didn't really recognize it. We see how powerful the mind is to create a state or to latch on to something that arises and make it more and more solid. Or by not latching on, to allow it to be in its original state, which is empty, right? That's why it can't persist. That's why it doesn't remain indefinitely, because that's not its nature. And then to move to being thoroughly pacified, whole body and mind. You know, when the Buddha taught the Four Immeasurables, he said, when you're invoking, may all beings be at peace, or be without suffering and know the source of their suffering. He said to infuse that into your whole body in all directions. Let the whole universe, which is sitting on your cushion, be permeated in all directions by that deep heartfelt wish. That is to be thoroughly permeated, thoroughly pacified, being the breath, being the koan, sitting within Shikantaza as a unified field. And here, the underlying tendencies are still there, so we see them more acutely. The judgment, the self-criticism, the fear, the sadness, the loneliness, those things that we have been experiencing our whole lives. But now we're able to respond more skillfully. And so it's natural and interesting and kind of curious that as we go deeper and things become more quiet and more still, that we can see deeper levels of agitation, deeper levels of dullness. Those that are in these deeper levels of consciousness that Buddhism has such profound understanding of. And that moves into one-pointedness, right? A deeper state of samadhi where all of these disparate pieces and parts and aspects and arisings and sensations and thoughts, everything becomes, is experienced, not becomes, but is experienced more one-pointedly. And at these latter stages, we become more and more aware of our tendency to self-control, to manage, to maintain, right? And we see the difficulty with really letting that go, trusting that deeply, not watching, not witnessing, not controlling, not managing. That the effort has become so absorbed within us and has been refined that it becomes more and more, it expresses itself more and more as effortlessness. And that's really, you know, in any skill that we're developing, it takes a lot of self-conscious and deliberate effort and skill building to get to the point where all of that drops away. It's not so much that it's invisible, it's just completely absorbed so it more naturally arises. And then to place the mind evenly, place evenly. Here the mind rests more naturally and evenly and with more constancy in its natural state. And of course, you know, when a teaching like this spells it out as a stages, you know, then we think, okay, am I in stage one? How do I know when I've crossed over into stage two? And so there is a kind of progression, of course, but without clear boundaries. And that we move back and forth. You know, we move back and forth, that there are moments of you know, of placing closely, you know, of one-pointedness. And then in another moment, the mind becomes active again, agitated, right? Or that concentration shifts and becomes dull, right? And so we have to enliven ourselves again. And so it's not, there's nothing fixed about it, but there is a kind of natural development that happens. And what we're also practicing at each step of the way is, I mean, it's hard to say it easily, but or well, but it's basically disidentifying. To not actively be identifying. You know, so that more and more the practice is just practice. There's just the breath. There's just the koan. There's just awareness. That's what Shikantaza means, just awareness. It's not I am being aware. It's awareness. And in that, both just and awareness drop away. Right? When there is no I am aware, then awareness itself drops away. When there's no more I am being the breath, then I and the breath and being drop away. And that is, there is no experience of that. Because the experience can only happen as long as there is subject and object continuing to be established. And so in the faith mind, when Chi Tao says, when no discriminating thoughts arise, the old mind ceases to exist. And that's just a way of speaking, right? It's not that you have an old mind and then you get a new mind. It's our old experience, the familiar old experience of mind, drops away. When thought objects vanish, the objects of our attention, the thinking subject, the one who has attention, drops away. As when the mind vanishes, right? When self-awareness vanishes, then the objects vanish. They are mutually arising, mutually dependent. They can't exist. They have no existence without each other. Object is object because of the subject. Subject is subject because of the object. I mean, if we really reflect on that, that has such incredibly all-pervading consequences and ramifications about everything. To understand the relativity of these two and their basic reality, the unity of emptiness, is what we're awakening. And what's also important to appreciate, you know, that this is also helping us to in a sense, create the condition for seeing things more clearly, things as they are, for insight, realization, awakening. And that those two aspects, the Buddha spoke of samadhi and prajna. And that naturally we think, well, if my mind is more tranquil, or only if my mind is more tranquil, can I have insight? And that's not true. And that's really important to understand. That it is understood that there are many different moments or different states of mind in which people have gained insight. Sometimes it comes out of a deep state of samadhi or tranquility, sometimes it doesn't. And that they interplay, tranquility and samadhi and insight or samadhi and prajna. They interplay, right? But it's really important to understand that, because otherwise we can sort of put ourselves in a box and think, well, my mind, you know, is just too active. And until it settles down to some, you know, measurable thing that I will determine, it's not possible that I can actually see beyond. And so in that box, you have made that true for yourself. You have created a reality which doesn't actually exist. It's not true. But you have fulfilled that idea, because that idea is so powerful, it will limit you. It will be self-limiting. And that's why it's so important to practice not knowing. Just don't know. Right? Because if you really look closely, you realize you don't. Right? And that's very helpful, because it just opens that up. You don't have to manage this, right? Please don't. It's much more restful, right, to let that go. Sitting atop the 100-foot pole. Though we gain entry, this is not yet the real. And so this is what I want to talk about tomorrow, because at every point along the way, our capacity to take what has no autonomous self, independent existence, permanence, absolute value, and in our mind to create a sense of permanence, value, quality, solidity, autonomy, is the strongest force, one of the strongest karmic forces that we possess. And so for all throughout our practice, really until we are perfectly enlightened, right? I'll meet you there. that ability, that tendency, that inclination, though it gets weaker and weaker, that ability to grab on to empty space is still present. It becomes more subtle. It can be harder to see. And so that's what the koan is really pointing to, and I'll talk about tomorrow. But I wanted just to, you know, spend a little bit of time talking about these aspects that we're you know, that's what we're doing today, is engaged in this practice that is, you know, has all of these, you know, sort of aspects and teachings and understandings. At its heart, you already know. In its heart, your mind, this is your mind. These qualities already exist within all of us. None of this is unfamiliar to us. Even in ordinary samsaric life, we're using these all the time. We bring our attention, we bring our focus to things. We recognize to some degree when things arise, whether they're healthy or not. Right? We have the capacity, and we use the capacity to place our mind somewhere. We all do that. Everybody does that in the world. Otherwise, who knows where we would be? Right? But they're not developed. They're not very well developed, right? We have been developing other things. And so we're just really turning in and sort of reclaiming or developing these very natural human conscious-based aspects and strengthening them, right? Because in that, our lives are transformed. In that, we realize our liberation. And so that's why it's so important to do what we're doing today. That's why it's so important to sit, you know, regularly. That's why it's important to do sesshin. That's why we are a meditation-based path, right? Which, as I spoke the other day, is a result of the Buddha's kind of radical interiorizing, his understanding that the whole universe both is, resides within, and springs forth from what is sitting on your cushion, right? And that everything is included. So let's continue and keep practicing and trust this very deep, deep teaching, right? You know, to trust the enlightenment of the Buddha. You know, this person who had really quite extraordinary ability to guide, to get help, but also to guide himself. And then this amazing capacity to express these teachings, right, in such a way that have had such power and that come down to us today. And that have been confirmed again and again and again. I mean, if this wasn't true, it would have died out. We're not fools. And so to really trust that and let that trust come into your own sit and your practice.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.